In an English courtroom.
Silence. Be upstanding in court. All persons who have anything to do before my lords, the Queen's Justices of Oya and Termina, and general jail delivery for the jurisdiction of the Central Criminal Court, draw near and give your attendance. God save the Queen.
Edward Small presents Tyrone Power, Marlena Dietrich, Charles Lawton in Agatha Christie's international stage success, Witness for the Prosecution. An Arthur Hornblow production with Elsa Lanchester, Una O'Connor, John Williams, Henry Daniel, Torrin Thatcher, Philip Tong, Ian Wolfe, and Francis Compton. Screenplay by Billy Wilder and Harry Kernitz. Adaptation by Larry Marcus. Director of Photography, Russell Harlan. Miss Dietrich's costumes, Edith Head. Sound, Fred Lau. Song, I May Never Go Home Anymore, by Ralph Roberts and Jack Brooks. Musical score, Matty Malnick. Music arranged by Leonid Robb. Music conducted by Ernest Gold. Produced by Arthur Hornblow Jr. Directed by Billy Wilder. A chauffeured car moves through the streets of London. In the back, a uniformed nurse sits by a portly gent in a Homburg hat.
What a beautiful day. I've been hoping we'd have a bit of sun for our homecoming. I always say it's worth having all the fog just to appreciate the sunshine.
Is there too much of draft? Shall I roll up the window?
Just roll up your mouth. You talk too much. If I'd have known how much you talked, I'd never have come out of my coma. This thing weighs a ton.
He throws off a blanket.
We've been flat on our back for 2 months. We'd better be careful.
He slaps her hand when she tucks the blanket around him. The car rolls through an archway into the Inns of Court.
Lovely, lovely. Must be perfectly lovely to live and work in the Inns of Court. How lucky you lawyers are. I almost married a lawyer once. I was in attendance when he had his appendectomy and we became engaged as soon as he could sit up. And then peritonitis set in and he went like that.
He certainly was a lucky lawyer.
The car stops in front of a corner building. She helps him out.
Teeny weeny steps now, Sir Wilfred. We must remember we had a teeny weeny heart attack.
Oh, shut up. Williams, my cane.
The chauffeur hands it to him and he heads for the door. Inside.
Here he comes!
Sir Wilfred's staff of four women and an elderly male clerk line up to greet him. One of the women holds a bouquet of flowers.
Good afternoon. Thank you very much, everybody. Back to work.
Sir Wilfred, if you don't mind, I would like to read you a little poem we've composed to welcome you back.
Very touching, Miss McHugh. You can recite it after office hours in your own time. Now back to work. What's the matter with you?
Nothing. I'm just happy that you're all self again.
Any more sentimentality around here, I shall instantly go back to the hospital.
Not very likely. They won't take him back. He wasn't really discharged, you know. He was expelled for conduct unbecoming a cardiac patient.
Put these in water, blabbermouth. Come on in, Carter.
He hands the flowers to the nurse and retires into his chambers with his clerk.
Look at this room. It's ugly, old and musty. I never knew I could miss anything so much.
Carter opens the blinds.
Missed you too, you musty old buzzard.
Oh, thank you, sir. I'm not a religious man, Sir Wilfred, but when they carted you off in that ambulance, I went out and lit a candle.
Why, thank you, Carter.
Actually, sir, I was lighting it for myself. If anything happened to you, what would happen to me after 37 years?
37 years? Has it been all that long?
Yes, sir. This is 1952. That was in October 1915. The Shepherd's Bush murder. The chemist accused of putting cyanide in his uncle's toothpaste.
Oh. My first murder trial. I was more frightened than the defendant. First time I rose to make an objection, my wig fell off.
Where's my wig?
Right here. I've guarded it with my life.
I hope it still fits. Lost 30 pounds in that wretched hospital. Still, I suppose my head isn't any smaller.
Putting on his monocle, he lifts the wig from its box and sniffs it.
What's all this?
We've put it in mothballs.
Mothballs? Am I not to practice again?
Of course you are. The solicitors have been breaking down our doors. I've lined up some very interesting briefs for you, sir.
What's better?
Divorce case, a tax appeal, and an important marine insurance claim.
Oh.
They're nice, smooth matters with excellent fees.
No, Carter.
I'm sorry, sir, but you're not to undertake any criminal cases. Not anymore. Your doctors have...
Doctors? They've deprived me of everything. Alcohol, tobacco, female companionship. If only they let me function on my work and something worthwhile.
Sorry, sir, Wilfred.
Might as well get a bigger box, more mothballs. Put me away, too.
2:30, Sir Wilfred. Time for a little nap.
Oh, get out.
Very bye. We'd better go upstairs now. Get undressed and lie down.
We? What a nauseating prospect.
Upstairs, please.
Are you aware, Miss Plimsoll, that while on my sick bed, I seriously considered strangling you with one of your own rubber tubes? I would then have admitted the crime, retained myself for the defense.
He claps on the wig.
My lord, members of the jury, I hereby enter a plea of justifiable homicide. For 4 months, this alleged angel of mercy has pawed, probed, punctured, pillaged and plundered my helpless body while tormenting my mind with a steady drip of baby talk.
Come along now, like a good boy. Oh, no.
You take your hands off me, Miss Plimsoll. I'll strike you with my cane.
Oh, you can never do that. You might break your cigars.
Cigars? What cigars?
The ones you're smuggling in your cane.
Cane?
She takes it from him, pulls off the rubber tip, and spills 3 cigars out on the carpet.
You could be jailed for this. You had no search warrant for my cane?
In hospital, he'd hide cigars and brandy all over the place. We called him Wilfred the Fox. I'm confiscating these.
Can't I have just one?
No. Upstairs.
A few puffs after meals, please.
He follows her with Carter.
Well, I'll do it. Some dark night when her back is turned, I'll snatch her thermometer and plunge it between her shoulder blades. Oh, well, no.
At the foot of the stairs...
Oh, no, sir. You mustn't walk up. We've installed something for you here. It's a lift, sir.
A lift? I'm getting sick of this plot to make me a helpless invalid.
I think it's a splendid idea. Let's try it, shall we?
Out of there. I'll try it. It's my lift because it was my heart attack.
He climbs aboard the chairlift.
Here you are. Simply press this button for up and this one for down.
Carter, I warn you if this contraption should collapse. If the banister should fall off the banister.
The chairlift rises steadily up the staircase. Sir Wilfred smiles in satisfaction.
This is remarkable, Carter. Smoothest flight I've had in years.
Oopsie daisy.
Once more to get the feel of the controls.
He starts back down. Halfway, a twinkle in his eye, he reverses direction. Behind Carter, the door opens and 2 men come in.
Good afternoon, Carter. Would it be possible to see Sir Wilfred? I'm sorry I didn't ring up an appointment, but this is urgent.
If it's about a brief, Mr. Mayhew, I'm sorry, but we're full up. Sir Wilfred has all that he can handle.
I'm sure he'll want this brief. Serious criminal matter.
The other man smiles and removes his fedora.
Absolutely not, Mr. Mayhew. Sir Wilfred is still convalescent. He can't possibly accept anything of an overstimulating nature.
Put me on a diet of bland civil suits. Hello, Mayhew.
Hello, Wilfred. This is very distressing news about your health.
Distressing? It's tragic. You better get yourself a younger man with younger arteries.
If you could just give us a few minutes. My client is here. This is Mr. Leonard Vole. He's in rather a ghastly mess, I'm afraid.
How do you do, Mr. Vole?
Vole smiles.
Well, according to Mr. Mayhew, I'm not doing at all well.
Sir Wilfred considers him.
Sir Wilfred, you are dawdling again.
Oh, shut up. Sorry, Mayhew. Try me again someday when you've something not too stimulating. Like a postman bitten by a stray dog.
As he rides up, Sir Wilfred spots the cigars in Mayhew's vest pocket.
Well, I wish you could help us, Wilfred, but I quite understand. Take care of yourself.
They turn to go.
Mayhew! Mayhew!
Oh, no. Sir Wilfred, please.
But don't worry, Carton. We won't take the brief. It's Mr. Mayhew's an old friend and he needs help. Surely I can give him a word of advice. Look, come on, Mayhew. I'll give you 5 minutes. No, I don't want you. Just Mayhew.
Our nap! Sir Wilfred! Our nap!
You go ahead. Start it without me.
He closes the door in her face.
It is your fault, Mr. Carter. You should not have permitted it.
It is not my fault. I distinctly told Sir Wilfred no criminal cases.
Well, if it's anyone's fault, I expect it's mine. Seems silly to me, but Mr. Mayhew thinks it's very urgent. He thinks I may be arrested at any minute.
Arrested for what?
Well, for murder.
Inside.
It's the case of Mrs. Emily French. You've probably seen the reports in the press. She was a middle-aged widow, rather well off, living with a housekeeper at Hampstead. Mr. Vole had been with her earlier in the evening. When the housekeeper returned from her day off, she found her mistress dead, struck on the back of the head and killed.
I see.
Vole seems a harmless chap, caught in a web of circumstantial evidence. Perhaps if I were to give you some more of the details, you might suggest the strongest line of defense.
Probably think better if you gave me one of those cigars.
Of course. There are no previous convictions, naturally. He's a man of good character with an excellent war record. You'd like him a lot.
They've confiscated the matches to a light. Please give me a light.
As I see it, the defense may turn on establishing an alibi for the night of the murder. I'm sorry, I haven't got any matches. Let me get you some.
Lord, no. You don't know Miss Plimsoll. This will take all our cunning.
Holding the cigar behind his back, he opens the door.
Young man, you come here, please. Your solicitor and I feel you may be able to enlighten me on a rather important point.
Yes, thank you.
Yes, Wilfred.
You're not in bed yet. Upstairs.
He closes the door in her face again.
Give me a match.
Sorry, I never carry them.
What? You said I'd like him.
But I do have a lighter.
You're quite right, Mayhew. I do like him. Thank you. Can you imagine Miss Plimsoll's face if she saw me now?
Then let's make absolutely sure that she doesn't.
Vole locks the door.
Splendid. With all the instincts of a skilled criminal.
Thank you, sir.
Here.
He returns the lighter and puffs happily on the cigar.
Young man, you may or may not have murdered a middle-aged widow, but you certainly saved the life of an elderly barrister.
I haven't murdered anybody. It's absurd. Christine, that's my wife. She thought I may be implicated and that I needed a lawyer. That's why I went to see Mr. Mayhew. Now he thinks he needs a lawyer, and now I have two lawyers. It's rather silly, don't you think?
Well, I am a solicitor. Sir Wilfred is a barrister. Only a barrister can actually plead a case in court.
Oh, I see.
She shall not even find the ashes.
He tips them into a drawer.
Sit down.
No, thank you. Well, I saw in the paper that poor Mrs. French had been found dead with her head bashed in. And it also said in the papers that the police were very anxious to interview me since I visited Mrs. French that evening. So, well, naturally, I went along to the police station.
Did they caution you?
I don't quite know. They asked me if I'd like to make a statement and said that they'd write it down and that it might be used against me in court. Would that be cautioning me?
Well, it can't be helped now.
Well, they were very polite and they seemed quite satisfied.
They seemed satisfied, Mr. Vole. He thinks that he made a statement and that's the end of it. Isn't it obvious to you, Mr. Vole, that you will be regarded as the principal and logical suspect in this case? I'm very much afraid you'll be arrested.
But I've done nothing. Why should I be arrested? I mean, this is England. You don't get arrested or convicted for something you haven't done.
We try not to make a habit of it.
But it does happen, though, doesn't it? Of course. There was that case of that fellow, what's his name, Adolf Beck or Becker. He'd been in jail for 8 years, and they suddenly found it was another chap altogether. He'd been innocent all along.
It's very unfortunate, but restitution has been made. He received a free pardon, a bounty from the Crown, and was restored to his normal life.
Yes, that's all right for him. But what if it had been murder? What if he'd been hanged? How would they have restored him to his normal life then, eh?
Mr. Vole, you must not take such a morbid point of view.
I'm sorry, it's just when you tell me that all these things are closing in on me, it's like a nightmare.
Relax, Mr. Vole. I'm putting you in the hands of the finest and most experienced barrister in London.
Now, Mayhew, let's get this straight. I may have done something highly unethical. I've taken your cigar and I'm not taking your case. I can't. I'm forbidden. My doctors would never allow it. I'm truly sorry, young man. However, if you'd like the case handled by someone in these chambers, I'd recommend Mr. Brogan-Moore. Well, you know Brogan-Moore.
Yes, I do. A very able man. I second Sir Wilfred's recommendation.
All right, sir, if you say so.
Sir Wilfred starts for the door, then turns back with the cigar.
Hold this.
Carter.
Yes, sir?
I would like to see Brokenmore here as soon as he comes in from court.
Very well.
Sir Wilfred, I have never known such insubordination. No, not even when I was a nurse in the front lines during the war.
What war was that? The Crimean War, no doubt.
He shuts the door.
You like Brokenmore. He's an excellent training. Under me.
This morning I had no lawyers at all, and now suddenly I have three lawyers. Perhaps we should explain to Sir Wilfred that I have very little money. I shan't be able to pay all the costs and fees.
Don't worry, we'll get a fourth lawyer to sue you.
Well, he won't get very much, I'm afraid. I haven't had a job in 4 months.
What sort of work do you do?
Well, my last job was as a mechanic with a motor servicing firm. And the foreman kept riding me all the time. I took it as long as I could, and then I quit.
And before that?
I worked in a department store in toys, demonstrating children's building sets. Of course, that lasted only during the Christmas rush. And before that, I had a job testing electric blankets.
Electric blankets?
I suppose you're thinking I'm a bit of a drifter, sir. Well, it's true in a way, but I'm really not like that. Doing my army service unsettled me a bit, that and living abroad. I was stationed in Germany. It was fine there, though. That's where I met Christine, my wife. She was an actress and a good one. She's a wonderful wife to me, too. But I haven't been much of a provider, I'm afraid. Somehow or other, I just don't seem to be able to settle down now that I've come back to this country. Of course, if I could just put my egg beater across...
Egg beater?
Yes, sir, I'm a bit of an inventor. Well, nothing big, just little household things. Pocket pencil sharpeners, keychain flashlights, and that sort of thing. But my best is really this egg beater. You see, it not only beats the egg, but it also separates the yolk from the white.
Is that really desirable?
If you were a housewife, Sir Wilfred, you'd see it right away. The only trouble is that I need money for manufacturing and promotion. I was really hoping that that's what Mrs. French might do for me after I met her.
Oh. Exactly how did you meet this Mrs. French?
Well, that's rather funny in itself. It was the 3rd of September. I remember distinctly because it's my wife's birthday. I was window shopping in Oxford Street, just sort of daydreaming about what I'd buy for her if I had any money.
Strolling past a millinery store, Vole pauses to watch a middle-aged woman trying on an ornately decorated wide-brimmed bonnet. When she notices him through the store window, he frowns and shakes his head. He lingers as she tries on a narrow-brimmed hat with a wide satin ribbon. This time, when she turns to him, he smiles and nods. Delighted, the woman steps over to the door.
You really like this one?
Oh, very much.
You don't think it's too mad?
Mad? Not at all. A little daring, perhaps. I wouldn't recommend it to every woman, but you, why shouldn't you attract some attention?
Oh, you really think so?
Absolutely. But if I could suggest one little thing,
yes.
Perhaps we could tip it and bring it back a bit like that. Show more of your face. My bus. Goodbye.
Before he runs off...
You buy that hat. I insist.
Back at Sir Wilfred's.
A ridiculous sort of hat. A silly thing with ribbons and flowers.
I'm constantly surprised that women's hats do not provoke more murders. Go on, please.
Well, I was only trying to be nice to her to make her feel good. I never dreamed that I'd see her again, or the hat.
But you did.
Yes, a few weeks later. Again, quite by accident. I was peddling my egg beaters that afternoon, and business was a little slow.
Vole is relaxing in a movie theater when a woman sits down in front of him. Finding his view obstructed by her hat, he finally taps her on the shoulder.
Would you mind, madam, your hat? Oh, it's you.
No! It's your fault, you know. You chose it yourself. May I?
Sure, if you like.
She moves into the seat beside him.
Thank you. Such a bother taking it off and putting it back on again.
That chap on the white horse is called Jesse James. Those others have led him into this ambush. It's not at all cricket.
Don't worry, Mr. James shoots his way out.
Oh, he does.
I've seen it before. I go to the movies quite a lot.
You do?
Oh, I get so restless at home, so I go out, and then I find I've really no place to go, so I go to the movies. Sometimes I see the same one 2 or 3 times. Ooh.
Yes, please.
A At this time, you had no idea that Mrs. French was well off.
No, no, absolutely not. We were sitting in the cheap seats. All I knew was that she seemed to be very lonely, had no friends whatsoever.
She and her husband had lived abroad for many years in British Nigeria. He was in the colonial service. He died in 45 of a heart attack.
Please may you not what I'm smoking. Go on, young man.
Well, they finally polished off Jesse James. And after we left the movie, she invited me to her house for tea.
Vole demonstrates his egg beater.
I think it's the most fascinating thing I've ever seen. Janet, come and look at this.
I've seen egg beaters before, ma'am.
Oh, but they beat so quickly and it separates, too. It must be centrifugal or centrifugal. Which is it? What is
it? Actually, it's specific gravity, but it whips cream, too.
Oh, did you hear that, Janet? It whips cream, too. We must have one. Is it expensive?
Compliments of the inventor, manufacturer, and sole distributor.
Oh, thank you. We'll use it constantly, won't we, Janet? Come, Mr. Bowl. We'd better get out of here. Janet doesn't like visitors in her kitchen.
Frowning sourly, the housekeeper watches them go. Then she flings the egg beater into the sink. In the living room...
Oh, it's a bit chilly in here, isn't it? Shall we have a fire?
Why not?
African artifacts are everywhere.
This is a charming room.
Hubert and I collected all these things when we lived in Africa. Hubert was my husband.
Well, now, there's a lovable chap.
That's the mask of the witch doctor. He always wore it when he pulled our servants' teeth. So Hubert used to call him a witch dentist. Hubert was so witty.
Yes, I can see that.
Oh, here's tea.
Janet enters with a tray.
Janet, let's use our good silver and china.
Oh, no, don't bother, Mrs. French. This is perfectly all right.
Lemon or milk, please?
Well, I don't really care.
Would you prefer some sherry?
Sherry would be fine.
We've not got any sherry.
Oh, but we had. There's that bottle, the one we bought last Christmas.
If you care for an eggnog, there happens to be a wasted egg in the kitchen already and separated.
Do sit down. Don't mind Janet, Mr. Bowl. It's just that she's terribly Scotch.
Oh, is she? I thought she came with a collection.
you know, maybe I'll take a glass of sherry myself. I feel like Christmas somehow.
After that, I used to see her once or twice a week. She always kept a bottle of sherry for me. We'd talk a bit, play canasta, listen to her old gramophone records. Gilbert and Sullivan, mostly. It's so weird to think of her now lying in that living room, murdered.
I assure you she's been moved by now. To leave her around be unfeeling, unlawful, and unsanitary.
Suppose you tell Sir Wilfred about the evening of the murder.
He empties the drawer of cigar ashes out the window.
Well, I went around to see her about 8 o'clock that evening. She fixed me a sandwich. We talked a bit, listened to the Mikado. I left about 9. I walked home. I got there about 9:30. I can prove that. I can swear to it, in or out of court, in the witness box, anywhere.
How much money did you get from her?
From whom?
From Mrs. French.
Well, nothing, not a quid.
The truth, how much?
Well, why should she give me any money?
Because she was in love with you.
Oh, that's ridiculous. She liked me. She pampered me like an aunt, but that's all, I swear.
Why didn't you tell her you were a married man?
I did tell her.
But you never took your wife along when you went there, did you?
No, I didn't.
Why not?
Well, because...
Because what?
Well, because Mrs. French was under the impression Christine and I didn't get along too well.
Is that true?
No, we love each other.
And how did she get that impression? Did you give it to her?
No, she just seemed to want to believe it that way.
She never corrected that impression. Why?
Well, I was afraid she'd lose interest in me.
Because she was rich?
Yes, I suppose so.
And you were after her money?
Well, yes, in a way. I was hoping for a loan for my new invention. Just a couple of £100. An honest business proposition, that's all it would have been. Is that so wicked?
You knew it was the housekeeper's day off?
Well, yes, I did.
So you went there because you knew she'd be alone?
No, I went there because I thought she might be lonely.
All right, lonely. You and the rich, lonely widow all alone in that lonely house with a gramophone blaring the Mikado. Perhaps you turned up the volume to drown out her cries.
No, when I left her, she was alive.
When the housekeeper came back, she was dead.
Well, the house had been ransacked. It said so in the papers. It must have been a burglar. Look, I didn't do it.
Sir Wilfred reflects light from his monocle into Vole's eyes.
You must believe me. You do believe me, don't you?
Sir Wilfred removes the monocle.
I do now, but I wasn't sure. That's why I subjected your eyes and my arteries to that ordeal. I'm sorry.
It's all right.
As for things looking bad, they don't look bad, Mr. Vole. They look terrible. Apparently, you've no alibi at all.
But I have. I left Mrs. French's at 9 o'clock.
How did you go home? By bus or underground?
No, I walked. It was a fine night.
Did anyone see you?
Yes, of course. Christine saw me when I got home. It was 9:26 exactly. I know because I went right to work on this new sort of clock thing that I've been tinkering with. My wife will tell you that.
Your wife loves you, does she not?
Very much, and I love her. We're devoted to each other.
Of course you realize, Mr. Vole, that the testimony of a devoted wife does not carry much weight.
You mean people might think Christine would tell a lie on my account?
It has been known, Mr. Vole. Blood is thicker than evidence.
The door opens.
Ah, oh, Broganmore, come in, come in.
So good to have you out of hospital.
I didn't get a full pardon. I'm out on parole. You know Mr. Mayhew, I believe. This is his client, Mr. Leonard Vole.
How do you do?
How do you do?
The Emily French murder.
Ah, how do you do?
Badly, thank you. There's a mass of circumstantial evidence, no alibi whatsoever. It's a hot potato. Tossing it right into your lap.
Much obliged.
Your line of defense, however, will be lack of motive. Well, you will agree that we can rule out her crime of passion, That leaves us with a murder for profit. Now then, if Mr. Vole had been sponging on Mrs. French, why kill her and cut off the source of supply? Or, if you'd been hoping for a golden egg, why kill the goose before it was laid? No motive, no motive whatsoever. You find some flaw in this line of reasoning?
No, it's very sound as far as it goes.
Well, it's all yours, Broganmore. You'll find Mr. Vole very responsive and quite candid. So candid, in fact, he's already informed me we'll have to sue him for our fees.
Oh, we'll simply put a lien on Mr. Vole's £80,000.
What £80,000?
The £80,000 Mrs. French left you.
Left me?
They opened Mrs. French's bank vault today and found her will.
He shows a newspaper.
Congratulations.
£80,000! And I was worried about a couple of hundred for that silly egg beater of mine, and now I must call Christine.
He strides to the phone. Then he notices their expressions.
Oh. Well, this inheritance doesn't make things look any better for me, though, does it?
No, I wouldn't think so.
So now they'll say that I did have a motive.
They will indeed. £80,000 makes for a very handsome motive.
I thought you were crazy, but I guess now they will arrest me, won't they?
It's not unlikely.
He turns to the window and sees a police car pull up in the street below.
As a matter of fact, it's quite likely they're on their way up now.
Look, I knew nothing about that will. I had no idea that Mrs. French had any intention of leaving me her money. And if I didn't know about it, how could it be a motive?
Mr. Broganmore will certainly bring that out in court.
It's our old friend, Inspector Hearn.
Chief Inspector, as of last month.
Chief Inspector? I must think a lot of you at Scotland Yard. You're getting the deluxe treatment.
He opens the door.
Oh, in here, Chief Inspector.
Sorry to disturb you in your chambers, Sir Wilfrid.
That's perfectly all right. I never object to the actions of the police, except once in a great while, in court.
Yes, sir. I still have the scars.
You know, Mr. Mayhew, Mr. Broganmore, this is dangerous Leonard Vole. You'd better search him. He may be armed with an egg beater.
Is your name Leonard Vole?
Yes, it is.
I have here a warrant for your arrest on the charge of murdering Emily French on October the 14th last. I must warn you that anything you say may be taken down and used in evidence.
Well, I'm ready. Must I be handcuffed?
Well, that won't be necessary, sir.
See, I've never been arrested before, not even for walking a dog off a lead or having a beer after hours.
There's no disgrace in being arrested, Mr. Vole. Kings, prime ministers, archbishops, even barristers have stood in the dock.
Vole picks up his hat.
Well, somebody better call my wife and tell her where they're taking me.
I will, don't worry.
I'll go to the station with you and see that you're properly charged.
You will see to it that Mr. Vole is well treated.
We will.
Would you like a cigar? Pardon me.
He plucks one from Mayhew's pocket and offers it to her.
Very kind of you, Sir Wilfrid.
I'd better not. It would constitute a bribe.
He sticks the cigar in his own pocket.
We ought to be going, Mr. Vole.
Well, there's one thing I've learned for sure. Never look in a window where there are women's hats.
Good day, sir.
Makes a very nice impression, doesn't he?
Yes, rather. Did you give him the monocle test?
Passed with flying colours.
Yeah, but I hope he does as well in the dock.
Yeah.
This is sticky, you know.
Of course it is. The prosecution will blast him with their heaviest artillery. All you'll have is one little pop gun, an alibi furnished by his wife. Isn't that an intriguing challenge?
I think I'd like it more if it was less of a challenge and less intriguing.
Sorry, Sir Wilfrid, but Miss Plimsoll has issued an ultimatum. If you're not in bed in 1 minute, she will resign.
Splendid. Give her a month's pay and kick her down the stairs.
Sir Wilfred, either you take proper care of yourself, or I too shall resign.
This is blackmail. You're quite right, Carter. My first day, this has already been rather hectic. I should be in bed.
He covers the cigar with his handkerchief.
Oh, I'd better get in touch with Mrs. Vole and have her come over. Will you sit in?
Thank you, no. I'm in no condition to cope with emotional wives drenched in tears. Ah, Miss Plimsoll, how alluring you look, waiting like a hangman on the scaffold. Take me, I'm yours.
He sits on the chairlift.
Oh, pardon, Mrs. Vole. Handle her gently, especially when you break the news of the arrest. Bear in mind, she's a foreigner, so be prepared for hysterics and even a fainting spell. Better have smelling salts ready, a box of tissues and a nip of brandy.
I do not think that will be necessary.
An attractive blonde woman stands in the doorway.
I never faint because I'm not sure that I will fall gracefully, and I never use smelling salts because they puff up the eyes. I'm Christine Vole.
How do you do? This is Mr. Brokenmoor.
How do you do?
I am Wilfred Robarts.
How do you do?
My dear Mrs. Vole, I'm afraid we have rather bad news for you.
Don't be afraid, Sir Wilfred. I'm quite disciplined.
There's nothing to be alarmed about as yet.
Leonard has been arrested and charged with murder. Is that it?
Yes.
I knew he would be. I told him so.
I'm glad you're showing such fortitude.
Call it what you like. What is the next step?
Your husband will have to stand trial, I'm afraid. Will you take Mrs. Vole inside and explain the procedure? Mr. Brogan-Moore will lead the defense.
Oh? You will not personally defend Leonard?
Regrettably not. My health, or rather the lack of it, forbids me.
It is regrettable. Mr. Mayhew described you as the champion of the hopeless cause.
He starts up in the chairlift.
Is it perhaps that this cause is too hopeless?
She looks up at him, but he keeps going.
I shall have a very serious talk with Dr. Harrison. It was a mistake to let you come back here. I shall take you directly to a rest home or resort, someplace quiet, far off, like Bermuda.
Shut up. You just want to see me in those nasty shorts.
Come now, Sir Wilfred. You must not think of it. You must get ready for sleep. Think beautiful thoughts.
Reluctantly, he lets her lead him off.
Now, let's get undressed. Put these on, tops and bottoms, while I make your bed. Now, after your rest, we'll have a nice cup of cocoa, and then perhaps we'll have a walk around the square. You know, I feel sorry for that nice Mr. Vole, and not just because he was arrested, but that wife of his. She must be German. I suppose that's what happens when we let our boys cross the channel. They go crazy. Personally, I think the government should do something about those foreign wives. Like an embargo. How else can we take care of our own surplus? Don't you agree, Sir Wilfred? All right. Hop in. Sir Wilfred.
Sir Wilfred has slipped out on her. In his chambers.
Yes, of course I knew that Leonard had been seeing Mrs. French quite frequently.
Go on.
I knew it from the day when he came home with a pair of queen socks she had knitted for him.
Well, that's quite natural, and I'm sure a jury will find it rather endearing.
Oh, Leonard can be very endearing. He hates that particular shade of green, and the socks were two sizes too large. But he wore them just the same, just to give her pleasure. Leonard has a way with women. I only hope he will have an all-woman jury. They will carry him from the courtroom in triumph.
A simple acquittal will do. Now, Mrs. Vole, you know that Mrs. French left your husband money?
Yes, a lot of money.
Of course, your husband had no previous knowledge of this bequest.
Is that what he told you?
Well, surely, Mrs. Vole, you're not suggesting anything different.
Oh, no. I do not suggest anything.
Quite obviously, Mrs. French had come to look upon your husband as a son, or perhaps a favorite nephew.
You think Mrs. French looked upon Leonard as a son, or a nephew?
I do. An entirely natural and understandable relationship.
What hypocrites you are in this country.
The two barristers exchange a glance.
Pardon me, Brother Moore. Mrs. Vole, do you mind if I ask you a question?
Go right ahead, Sir Wilfred.
Mrs. Vole, you realize your husband's entire defense rests on his word and yours.
I realize that.
And that the jury will be quite skeptical of the word of a man accused of murder when supported only by the word of his wife.
I realize that, too.
Let us then at least make sure that the two are not in conflict.
He subjects her to the monocle test.
Mrs. Vole, I assume you want to help your husband.
Of course I want to help Leonard. I want to help Mr. Brogan Moore, and I want to help you, Sir Wilfred.
Stepping over to the window,
there.
She lowers the blind.
Isn't that more comfortable for you?
Now, Mrs. Vole, this is very important. On the night of the murder, your husband came home before 9:30. Is that correct?
Precisely. Isn't that what he wants me to say?
Isn't it the truth?
Of course. But when I told it to the police, I do not think they believed me. Maybe I didn't say it well. Maybe because of my accent.
My dear Mrs. Vole, in our courts, we will accept the evidence of witnesses who speak only Bulgarian and who must have an interpreter. We will accept the evidence of deaf mutes who cannot speak at all as long as they tell the truth.
You're aware, of course, that when I put you in the witness box, you will be sworn and you will testify under oath.
Yes. Leonard came home at 9:26 precisely and did not go out again. The truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. Is that better?
Mrs. Vole, do you love your husband?
Leonard thinks I do.
Well, do you?
Am I already under oath?
Mrs. Vole, whatever your gambit may be, do you know that under British law you cannot be called to give testimony damaging to your husband?
How very convenient.
We are dealing with a capital crime. The prosecution will try to hang your husband.
He is not my husband.
The barristers are stunned by this. She raises the blind.
Leonard and I went through a form of marriage in Hamburg, but I had a husband living at the time somewhere in East Germany in the Russian zone.
Did you tell Leonard?
I did not. It would have been stupid to tell him. He would not have married me, and I would have been left behind to starve in the rubble.
But he did marry you and brought you safely to this country. Don't you think you should be very grateful to him?
One can get very tired of gratitude.
Your husband loves you very much, does he not?
Leonard? He worships the ground I walk on.
And you?
You want to know too much. Auf Wiedersehen, gentlemen.
Thank you for coming in, Mrs. Vole. Your visit has been most reassuring.
Do not worry, Sir Wilfred. I will give him an alibi, and I shall be very convincing. There will be tears in my eyes when I say, Leonard came home at 9:26 precisely.
You're a very remarkable woman, Mrs. Vole.
And you're satisfied, I hope?
I'm damned if I'm satisfied.
Care to join me in a whiff of those smelling salts?
Woman's up to something, but what?
The prosecution will break her down in no time when I put her in the witness box. You know, defending this case is going to be rather like the charge of the Light Brigade or one of those Japanese suicide pilots. Quite one-sided, with the odds all on the other side. I haven't got much to go on, have I? The fact is, I've got nothing.
Let me ask you something. Do you believe Leonard Vole is innocent? Do you? Do you?
Brogan Moore shakes his head.
I'm not sure. Oh, I'm sorry, Wilfred. Of course, I'll do my best.
It's all right, Brogan Moore. I'll take it from here.
He pulls the cigar from his pocket.
I've called Dr. Harrison and given him a complete report on your shocking behavior. I can no longer...
Give me a match, Miss Grimshaw.
Sir Wilfred!
Did you hear me, a match?
Overruled, Nurse Plimsoll hastens to obey. In the jail, Leonard Vole is escorted from his cell, down the stairs, to a meeting room.
Hello, Mr. Mayhew. Sir Wilfred, Mr. Mayhew tells me that you are going to represent me. I'm very grateful.
I struck a bargain with my doctors. I let them exile me to Bermuda as soon as we finish your case.
Thank you.
Let us hope that we shall both survive.
Get into these, will you? We need a photograph.
What for?
Because these were what you were wearing on the night of the murder. You want to circulate a photograph on the chance that someone did see you leaving Mrs. French on your way home.
Over here against the wall, please.
Vole poses in his hat and trench coat.
Hold it. Now,
One more in profile, please.
I mean, after all, do we really need this? My wife knows what time I came home that night.
A disinterested witness may be of more value.
Yes, of course, Christine is an interested witness.
I'll pick up the negatives later, thank you.
I don't understand it. Why hasn't she come to see me? Won't they let her see me? I mean, it's been 2 weeks now.
May you give me the reports.
Have you been talking to her? Is there something the matter with her?
I want to read you a portion of the evidence of Janet McKenzie, the housekeeper. Mr. Vole helped Mrs. French with her business affairs, particularly her income tax returns.
Oh, yes, I did. Some of those forms are very complicated.
There's also a hint you may have helped her draft her new will.
Oh, that's not true. If Janet said that, she's lying. She was always against me. I don't know why.
It's quite obvious. You threw an egg beater into the wheels of her Victorian household. Now, what about this cut in your wrist? You told the police you'd cut yourself with a knife?
Well, that's true. I did. I was cutting bread and the knife slipped. But that was 2 days after the murder. Christine was there. She'll tell them when she gives evidence. Are you keeping something from me? Is she ill? Was she shocked by what happened to me?
All things considered, I think she took it very well. Of course, that may have only been on the surface. Wives are often profoundly disturbed at such a time.
Yes, it must be hard on her. We've never been separated before, not since our first meeting.
How did you meet your wife, Mr. Vole?
In Germany in 1945. It's rather funny. The very first time I saw her, the ceiling fell right in on me. I was stationed outside Hamburg with an RAF maintenance unit.
In uniform, he strolls by a poster of a shapely singer outside a basement bar and decides to go in.
Come on, join the party. Have a hearty glass of rum. Don't ever think about tomorrow, or tomorrow may never come.
The large room is smoky and crowded with men in uniform.
That's where I want to stay. Time is nothing as long as
Vole gets a drink at the bar, then moves where he can see the stage.
I may never go home anymore. Dim the lights and start locking the door.
Christine, playing the accordion, entertains the men. She's dressed in a merchant marineman's outfit with flared trousers.
I've got kisses and kisses galore that have never been tasted before. If you treat me right, this could be the night. I may never go home.
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 I may never go home anymore.
She steps down among the men.
Hey, Pauline, show us some legs. They robbed your partner and they throw you runny cider. Come on, let's see them. We want legs. Come on, the camera.
Trousers.
All right, Pauline, if you won't show them, I will.
As she steps back up on the stage, a soldier tears off one leg of her trousers, exposing her shapely leg. Other soldiers crowd in, and instantly, a free-for-all erupts. Outside, the MPs arrive in force. They rush into the bar and wade into the melee with their sticks. Vole finds a place to leave his unfinished drink and then slips away. The MPs herd the troops outside and manhandle them into trucks. As the last of them drives off, Vole emerges from a doorway. He pauses on his way back into the bar to smooth out the out-of-bounds notice that's been slapped on the poster of the shapely singer. Inside, the waiters are trying to restore some order. Vole retrieves his drink and watches Christine poking through the wreckage on hands and knees, her bare legs still exposed.
Gesundheit.
She glances up at him through her long blonde hair, then resumes poking.
What are you looking for?
My accordion.
Oh, let me help you.
He freezes.
I think I found it.
Step on it again. It's still breathing.
I'm terribly sorry.
You better get out of here. You've had trouble enough.
Well, actually, it's your own fault. That costume in the picture outside gave the boys ideas, and then those trousers of yours let them down hard.
That costume went in the first raid on Hamburg, and raid by raid the rest of my dresses, and now you've bombed my trousers.
Cigarette, gum?
She takes the gum. Distracted by her bare leg, he offers her a light.
You're burning my nose.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's all right.
How about a cup of coffee? I've got a tin of coffee.
How much?
Well, I don't know. What's the rate of exchange?
Depends whether it's fresh coffee or powdered coffee.
It's instant coffee.
Oh.
Got any hot water at your place?
Sometimes.
Let's take a chance. Where do you live?
Nearby. Come.
He follows her through a curtain into a dingy back room.
Sorry, it's the maid's night off.
This is pretty horrible. In a gemütlich sort of way.
Oh, it's fine now. I used to have a roommate, a dancer. She had luck. She married a Canadian. She now lives in Toronto. She has a Ford automobile. You better make yourself comfortable. The stove is slow these days.
Oh, that's all right. I've got a weekend pass.
No, no, not that chair. It holds up the beam and that holds up half the ceiling. You better sit down on the cot.
The cot? It's getting more gemütlich all the time. Are you married?
Why?
Well, the,
She has a ring.
Oh, that? No, no, I'm not married. I just wear it when I'm working. It gives me a little protection with all the men.
Didn't work too well tonight, though, did it?
No, tonight was bad. But it's getting better.
She smiles at him.
Where's the coffee?
Ah, coffee, jawohl. The finest Brazilian blend. The same brand that Field Marshal Montgomery drinks.
He spoons some into one of the cups she holds out, then looks up at her and gestures with the spoon. She gives him a little kiss. When he spoons some into the other cup, she gives him a better kiss.
Is that a fair rate of exchange?
Very fair. Would you be interested in having the whole tin?
I would.
He hands it to her. Then he takes her in his arms and kisses her seriously.
How are you fixed for sugar?
I could use some.
Milk?
Sure.
Milk? Sugar.
He pulls them from his rucksack.
It's a pleasure to do business with you.
Yeah.
He moves close to kiss her again. Then...
I also carry biscuits, powdered eggs, bacon, marmalade.
He empties the rucksack.
I don't know if I can afford it.
Don't worry. We'll work out something like an installment plan. I may never go home anymore.
He flops on the cot, and half of the ceiling collapses. Christine hurries to him.
Oh, I'm terribly sorry. Now you have no ceiling. Well, maybe I can fix it. I'm good at it.
Why fix it? It's not raining.
Ooh.
Are you all right?
Yes, I think so. My head aches a little.
Maybe I can fix it. I'm good at it.
She leans down and kisses him. His arms encircle her.
I had a weekend pass, a month's pay in my pocket.
And she already had a wedding ring?
Yes, that's right. So we got married. And as soon as I got out of the service, I brought her to England. That was wonderful. I rented a little flat, Edgware Road. First time she saw it, Christine was so happy, she broke down and cried.
Naturally, she had a solid roof over her head and a British passport.
You don't really know, Christine, how she feels about me. But you will when she gives her evidence.
Mr. Vole, I must tell you I am not putting her in the witness box.
You're not? Why not?
Well, for one thing, she's a foreigner, not too familiar with the subtleties of our language. The prosecution could easily trip her up.
I hear it may be Mr. Myers for the Crown. We can't take chances with him.
Quite. Well, we better be going. Miss Plimsoll is waiting in the car with her pills and a thermos of lukewarm cocoa.
Officer, but Christine must give evidence.
Mr. Vole, you must learn to trust me. For no other reason than that I am a mean, ill-tempered old man who hates to lose. Let us wish each other luck.
They shake hands, but Vole is far from reassured. He turns back in the door.
I can't face this without Christine. I tell you, I'm scared. I need her. Without her, I'm sunk.
Touching, isn't it? The way he counts on his wife.
Yes, like a drowning man clutching at a razor blade.
Some days later, the Statue of Justice is under repair high atop the domed roof of the courthouse.
Leonard Stephen Vole.
Inside.
You are charged on indictment for that you, on the 14th day of October, in the County of London, murdered Emily Jane French. How say you, Leonard Stephen Vole? Are you guilty or not guilty?
The courtroom is packed.
Not guilty.
Members of the jury, the prisoner stands indicted for that he, on the 14th day of October, murdered Emily Jane French. To this indictment, he has pleaded not guilty. And it is your charge to say, having heard the evidence, whether he be guilty or not.
Vole, guarded by two bailiffs, takes his seat in the dock as the judge addresses the jury.
Members of the jury, by the oath which you have just taken, you have sworn to try this case on the evidence. You must shut out from your minds everything except what will take place in this court. You may proceed for the prosecution, Mr. Myers.
May it please you, my lord. Members of the jury, I appear in this case with my learned friend, Mr. Barton, for the prosecution, and my learned friends, Sir Wilfrid Robarts and Mr. Brogan Moore, appear for the defense.
He notices Sir Wilfrid's place is empty.
I trust we are not to be deprived of the learned and stimulating presence of Sir Wilfrid.
My lord, may I assure my learned friend of the prosecution that Sir Wilfrid is in the Old Bailey. He's slightly incapacitated, but he'll be in his seat presently.
My lord, may I express my regret that Sir Wilfrid is even slightly incapacitated?
You may, Mr. Myers. You may also proceed with the case for the prosecution.
Thank you, my lord. The facts in this case are simple, and to a point not in dispute. You will hear how the prisoner made the acquaintance of Mrs. Emily French, a woman of 56. How he was treated by her with kindness and even affection. On the night of October the 14th last, between 9:30 and 10, Mrs. French was murdered. Medical testimony will be introduced to prove the death was caused by a blow from a blunt and heavy instrument, and it is the case for the prosecution that the blow was dealt by the prisoner, Leonard Vole.
That's not true. I didn't do it.
The bailiffs restrain Vole.
Among the witnesses, you will hear police evidence, also the evidence of Mrs. French's housekeeper, Janet McKenzie, and from the medical and laboratory experts, and the evidence of the murdered woman's solicitor who drew her final will. I will now call Chief Inspector Hearn, Criminal Investigation Department, New Scotland Yard.
Chief Inspector Hearn. Chief Inspector Hearn.
Chief Inspector Hearn.
Hearn enters and makes his way through the courtroom to the witness box. Meanwhile, in the barrister's cloakroom...
This is ridiculous. Just a bit of nervous heartburn. I always get it the first day of a trial.
240 above 130. You shouldn't be here at all.
I should be in the courtroom. The trial's begun.
Syringe, please.
Be a good, brave boy, Sir Wilfrid.
Miss Plimsoll, it may interest you to know that I am descended from a warrior family which traces its brave past back to Richard the Lion-hearted.
The doctor injects him.
You're to have a calcium injection daily, tranquilizing pill every hour.
I'll set my wristwatch alarm.
In case of a sudden pain or shortness of breath, pop one of these nitroglycerin tablets from the black box under your tongue. Oh, and I'll leave you some drops
for... That's enough, Doctor. The judge will be asking for a saliva test. Carter, I'd better take that thermos of cocoa with me. Helps me wash down the pills.
Let me see it, please. My learned patient is not above substituting brandy for cocoa. It is cocoa. So sorry.
If you were a woman, Miss Plimsoll, I would strike you and take care of this, Carter.
Now, Sir Wilfred, in the courtroom, you must avoid overexcitement.
With his back turned, Carter switches the thermos of cocoa for an identical thermos.
Thank you, Doctor. I shall be quite safe, what with the pills and the cocoa.
He grabs his wig.
Come along, Carter.
In the courtroom...
From the body temperature and other factors, we placed the time of death at between 9:30 and 10 p.m., approximately 30 minutes before Janet McKenzie, the housekeeper, returned home and called us.
Sir Wilfred enters and hurries to his place on the barrister's bench with a reassuring glance at Vole.
Were there any signs of a struggle?
None. Just the one blow.
Would that indicate to you that the murderer had taken Mrs. French by surprise?
My lord, I must object. My learned friend refers to the assailant as the murderer. We have not yet determined whether the assailant was a man or a woman. It could quite conceivably have been the murderess.
Mr. Myers, it seems that Sir Wilfred has joined us just in time to catch you on a point of grammar. Please rephrase your question.
Yes, my lord. Inspector, is it your opinion that the assailant, whether he, she, or it, had taken Mrs. French by surprise?
My lord, I am taken by surprise as my learned friend should attempt to solicit from the witness an opinion and not a fact.
Quite so. You'll have to do better than that, Mr. Myers.
My lord, I withdraw the question entirely. Is that better?
That's much better.
As Sir Wilfred finds a place on the bench for his thermos, Miss Plimsoll bustles into the upper gallery and makes a place for herself by a young woman.
Very well, Inspector. Let us proceed with the facts in the case.
She sets her wristwatch alarm.
What did you then do?
A search was made, photographs were taken, and the premises were fingerprinted.
What fingerprints did you discover?
I found the fingerprints of Mrs. French, those of Janet McKenzie, and some which later proved to be those of Leonard Vole.
No others?
No others.
Now, did you say that the room had the appearance that a robbery had been committed?
Yes. Things were strewn about, and a window had been broken near the catch. There was glass on the floor, and fragments were found outside. The glass outside was not consistent with the window having been forced from the outside.
What you are saying is that someone attempted to make it look as if the window had been forced from the outside. Isn't that so?
My lord, I must object. My learned friend is putting words in the witness's mouth. After all, if he insists on answering his own questions, the presence of the witness would seem superfluous.
Quite. Don't you think so, Mr. Myers?
Yes, my lord. Inspector, did you ascertain if any of the murdered woman's property was missing?
According to the housekeeper, nothing was missing.
In your experience, Inspector, when burglars or burglaresses break into a house, do they leave without taking anything?
No, sir.
Do you produce a jacket, Inspector?
Yes, sir.
Is that the jacket?
Hearn inspects it.
Yes, sir.
That is Exhibit P1, my lord. Where did you find this, Inspector?
That is the jacket found in the prisoner's flat, which I handed to our lab to test for bloodstains.
And did you find any bloodstains?
Yes, though an attempt had been made to wash them out.
What tests did the laboratory make?
First, to determine if the stains were made by human blood, then to classify it by group or type.
And was the blood of a particular group or type?
Yes, sir. It is type O.
And did you subsequently test the blood of the dead woman?
Yes, sir.
What type was that?
The same. Type O.
Thank you, Inspector. No further questions.
Vole looks anxiously at the jury.
You said that the only fingerprints you found were those of Mrs. French, Janet McKenzie, and the prisoner Leonard Vole. In your experience, when a burglar breaks in, does he usually leave fingerprints or does he wear gloves?
He wears gloves.
So the absence of fingerprints in the case of robbery would hardly surprise you.
No, sir.
Can't we then surmise the burglar might have entered what was presumably an empty house, might have suddenly encountered Mrs. French and struck her, then realizing she was dead, panicked and fled without taking anything?
I submit, my lord, that it is entirely impossible to guess what went on in the mind of some entirely imaginary burglar, with or without gloves.
Let us not surmise, Sir Wilfred, but confine ourselves to facts.
Inspector, when you questioned the prisoner as to the stains on his jacket, did he not show you a recently healed scar on his wrist and tell you that he had cut himself with a kitchen knife while slicing bread?
Yes, sir. That is what he said.
And were you not told the same thing with the prisoner's wife?
Yes, sir. But afterwards...
Just a simple yes or no, please. Did the prisoner's wife show you a knife and tell you that her husband had cut his wrist while slicing bread?
Yes, sir.
I will ask you to examine this knife, Inspector.
A bailiff brings it from the evidence table.
Just test the edge of it with your finger. Carefully. You agree that the point and the cutting edge are razor sharp?
Yes, sir.
Now then, if such a knife were to slip, might it not inflict a cut that would bleed profusely?
Yes, sir, it might.
Now, Inspector, you have stated that the blood stains on the prisoner's jacket were analyzed, as was the blood of Mrs. French, and they were both found to be of the same group, group O.
That is correct.
However, if the prisoner's blood were also of this same group, then the stains on his jacket might very well have resulted from the household accident he described to you.
Yes.
Did you examine the prisoner's blood, Inspector?
No, sir.
I have here a certificate stating that Leonard Stephen Vole is a blood donor at the North London Hospital and that his blood is group O.
He flicks off his monocle.
Thank you, Inspector.
As the jury members digest this, Vole dabs at the sweat on his lip.
Inspector, granted that the cut on the wrist was caused by that knife, is there anything to show whether it was an accident or done deliberately after the murder to account for the bloodstains?
Oh, well, my lord.
I withdraw the question. You may stand down, Inspector. Call Janet McKenzie.
Janet McKenzie.
Janet McKenzie.
Janet McKenzie.
The housekeeper enters. She notices Vole in the dock and then makes her way to the witness box. The court clerk switches the Bible to her right hand and puts the oath in her left.
I swear by Almighty God.
In the gallery... It's Plimsoll's watch. She signals down to Carter, who slips over to Sir Wilfred with the box of pills.
Your name is Janet McKenzie?
Aye, that's my name.
Sir Wilfred looks up at Plimsoll and nods.
When did you first come to London?
28 years ago.
Where do you live?
I moved in with my niece at 19 Glenister Road.
As Plimsoll and the pretty young woman beside her watch, he pours a drink from his thermos, holds a pill up to Plimsoll, pops it into his mouth, and washes it down.
You were companion housekeeper to the late Mrs. Emily French.
Eyes twinkling, he trades smiles with Plimsoll.
10 years I was with her and looked after her. Oh, many's the time. I prevented her doing a foolish thing.
Please tell us in your own words about the events of the evening of October the 14th.
It was a Friday and my night out. I was going round to see my niece at Glenister Road, which is about 5 minutes' walk. I left the house at 7:30. I promised to take her a dress pattern that she admired.
She frowns at the microphone.
Is this thing necessary?
An excellent question. However, it has been installed at considerable expense to the taxpayers, so let us take advantage of it. Please continue.
Well, when I got to my niece's, I found it left the pattern behind. So after supper, I slipped back to get it, as it was no distance. I got back to the house at 9:25. I let myself in and went upstairs to my room. As I passed the sitting room, I heard a prisoner in there, talking to Mrs. French.
No, it wasn't me. It wasn't my voice.
The bailiffs restrained Vole.
Talking and laughing they were. But it was no business of mine, so I went upstairs and I fetched my pattern.
Now, let us be very exact as to the time. You say that you re-entered the house at 25 past nine?
Aye. The pattern was on a shelf in my room next to my clock, so I saw the time. And it was 25 past nine.
Go on, please.
I went back to my niece. Oh, she was delighted with the pattern.
She's pushed the microphone aside. The judge indicates she must use it.
Simply delighted. I stayed there until 20 to 11, and then I said goodnight to them and I come home. I went into the sitting room then to see if the mistress wanted anything before she went to bed. And there she was, dead, and everything tossed hither and thither.
Did you really think that a burglary had been committed?
My lord, I must protest.
I will not allow that question to be answered, Mr. Myers.
Miss Mackenzie, were you aware that Leonard Vole was a married man?
No, indeed. And neither was the mistress.
Janet! My lord, I must object. What Mrs. French knew or did not know is pure conjecture on Janet Mackenzie's part.
Let me put it this way. You formed the opinion that Mrs. French thought Leonard Vole was a single man. Have you any facts to support that opinion?
Well, there were the books that she ordered. There was The Life of the Baroness Burdett Coutts and the one about Disraeli and his wife. Both of them about women that married men years younger than themselves. Oh, I knew what she was thinking.
I'm afraid we cannot admit that.
Why?
Members of the jury, it is possible for a woman to read The Life of Disraeli without contemplating marriage with a man younger than herself.
Miss Mackenzie, were you aware of what arrangements Mrs. French had made for the disposal of her money?
She had her old will revoked and a new one drawn up. I heard her calling Mr. Stokes' solicitor. He was there at the time. The prisoner, I mean.
You heard Mrs. French and the prisoner discussing her new will?
Yes. He was to have all her money, she told him, as she had no near relations nor anybody that meant to her what he did.
When did this take place?
On October the 8th. 1 week to the day before she was murdered.
Thank you. That concludes my examination.
She starts to leave the witness box.
Not just yet, Miss Mackenzie. Would you... Thank you. Miss Mackenzie, you have given evidence about two wills. In the old will, the will that was revoked, were you not to receive the bulk of Mrs. French's estate?
Aye, that's so.
Whereas in the new will, except for a bequest due of a small annuity, the principal beneficiary is the prisoner Leonard Vole.
It'll be a wicked injustice if he ever touches a penny of that money.
It is entirely understandable that you are antagonistic to the prisoner.
Oh, I'm not antagonistic to him. He's a shifter, scheming rascal. But I'm not antagonistic to him.
I suggest you form this opinion because his friendship with your mistress cost you the bulk of her estate.
I never liked him.
Your candor is refreshing. Now, on the night of October the 14th, you say you heard the prisoner and Mrs. French talking together. What did you hear them say?
I didn't hear what they actually said.
You mean you only heard the voices, the murmur of voices?
They were laughing.
What makes you say the man's voice was Leonard Vole's?
I know his voice well enough.
The door was closed, was it not?
Aye, that's so.
You were no doubt in a hurry to get the pattern, so you probably walked quickly past the closed door, yet you were sure you heard Leonard Vole's voice?
I was there long enough to hear what I heard.
Come, Miss Mackenzie. I'm sure you don't wish to suggest to the jury that you were eavesdropping.
I know it was him in there with her. Who else could it have been?
Exactly. What you mean is that you wanted it to be him. That's the way your mind worked. Now tell me, did Mrs. French sometimes watch television in the evening?
Yes. She was fond of a talk or a good play.
Wasn't it possible on the evening when you returned home and passed the door that what you really heard was the television and a man and woman's voices and laughter? There was a play called Lover's Leap on the television that night.
It was not the television.
Oh, why not?
Because the television was away being repaired that week. That's why.
Taken aback, Sir Wilfred sits down and pours a shot from his thermos.
Silence! Silence!
Miss Plimsoll checks her watch.
Odd. It's not time yet.
If my learned friend has no further questions, I would like to...
I have not quite finished. You are registered, are you not, under the National Health Insurance Act?
Aye, that's so. 4 and 6 pence are paid every week. Och, that's a terrible lot of money for a working woman to pay.
I am sure that many agree with you. Now then, Miss Mackenzie, did you recently apply to the National Health Insurance for a hearing aid?
She strains to hear him.
What?
My lord, I must protest against the manner in which this question is being put. I will repeat the question, my lord. I asked you in a normal tone of voice audible to everyone in open court, did you apply to the National Health Insurance for a hearing aid?
Yes, I did.
Did you get it?
No, not yet.
However, you state that you walked past a door which is 4 inches of solid oak. You heard voices, and you are willing to swear that you could distinguish the voice of the prisoner, Leonard Vole. No further questions.
Oh, maybe you could help me, your lordship. 6 months ago, I applied for my hearing aid, and I'm still waiting for it.
My dear Miss Mackenzie, considering the rubbish that is being talked nowadays, you are missing very little. You may stand down now.
Call Police Constable Jeffries. Police Constable Jeffries.
Police Constable Jeffries.
The housekeeper pauses to glare at Vole on her way out of the courtroom.
I swear by Almighty God that the evidence I shall give shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
At a newspaper stand outside an underground station, the billboard announces Vole trial in third day. In the courtroom.
Mr. Myers, does that conclude your case?
No, my lord. I now call the final witness for the prosecution, Christine Helm.
Christine Helm! Christine Helm! Christine
Helm! Vole and his lawyers are stunned. Christine makes her way through the courtroom toward the witness box. She doesn't look at Vole.
Christine.
I swear by Almighty God that the evidence I shall give shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
My lord, I have the most serious objection to this witness being summoned by the prosecution, as she is the wife of the prisoner, Leonard Vole. My lord, I call my learned friend's attention to the fact that I summon not Mrs. Vole, but Mrs. Helm. Your name, in fact, is Christine Helm?
Yes, Christine Helm.
And you have been living as the wife of the prisoner, Leonard Vole?
Yes.
Are you actually his wife?
No. I went through a marriage ceremony with him in Hamburg. But I already had a husband. He's still alive.
Christine, that's not true!
My lord, there is proof of a marriage between the witness and the prisoner. But is there any proof of a so-called previous marriage? My lord, the so-called previous marriage is in fact well documented. Mrs. Helm, is this a certificate of marriage between yourself and one Otto Ludwig Helm? The ceremony having taken place in Breslau on the 18th of April, 1942.
Yes, that is the paper of my marriage.
I don't see any reason why this witness should not be qualified to give evidence.
The certificate is passed to Sir Wilfred, who waves it away.
Mrs. Helm, are you willing to give evidence against the man you've been calling your husband?
Yes.
You stated to the police that on the night that Mrs. French was murdered, Leonard Vole left the house at 7:30 and returned at 25 minutes past nine. Did he in fact return at 25 past nine?
No. He returned at 10 minutes past 10.
Christine, what are you saying? It's not true. You know it's not true.
Silence! I must have silence. As your counsel will tell you, Vole, you will very shortly have an opportunity of speaking in your own defense.
Leonard Vole returned, you say, at 10 minutes past 10. And what happened next?
He was breathing hard, very excited. He threw off his coat and examined the sleeves. Then he told me to wash the cuffs. They had blood on them.
Go on.
I said, Leonard, what have you done?
And what did the prisoner say to that?
He said, I've killed her.
Christine, why are you lying? Why are you saying these things?
In the gallery.
What an awful woman.
Oh, she's evil, that one. I've known it all along.
If the defense so desires, I will adjourn for a short time so that the prisoner may gain control of himself.
My lord is most gracious, but pray let the witness continue. We are all of us caught up in the suspense of this horror fiction. To have to hear it in installments might prove unendurable.
Proceed, Mr. Myers.
Mrs. Helm, when the prisoner said, I have killed her, did you know to whom he referred?
It was that woman he had been going to see so often.
Now then, when questioned by the police, you told them that the prisoner returned at 9:25.
Yes, because Leonard asked me to say that.
But you've changed your story now. Why?
I cannot go on lying to save him. I said to the police what he wanted me to say because I'm grateful to him. He married me and brought me to this country. What he has asked me to do, I've always done because I was grateful.
It was not because he was your husband and you loved him.
I never loved him.
It was gratitude to the prisoner then that prompted you to give him an alibi in your statement to the police.
That is it. Exactly.
But now you think it was wrong to do so.
Because it is murder. That woman, she was a harmless old fool. And he makes of me an accomplice to the murder. I cannot come into court and swear that he was with me at the time when it was done. I cannot do it. I cannot do it!
Then this is the truth. That Leonard Vaux returned that night at 10 minutes past 10, that he had blood on the sleeves of his coat, and that he said to you, I have killed her.
That is the truth.
That is the truth before God.
That is the truth.
Thank you.
Mrs. Vaux, or Mrs. Helm, which do you prefer to be called?
It does not matter.
Does it not? In this country, we are inclined to take a rather more serious view of marriage. However, Frau Helm, it would appear, when you first met the prisoner in Hamburg, you lied to him about your marital status?
I wanted to get out of Germany, so...
You lied, did you not? Just yes or no, please.
Yes.
Thank you. And subsequently, in arranging the marriage, you lied to the authorities?
I did not tell the truth to the authorities.
You lied to them?
Yes.
And in the ceremony of marriage itself, when you swore to love and to honor and to cherish your husband, that too was a lie?
Yes.
And when the police questioned you about this wretched man who believes himself married and loved, you told them?
I told them what Leonard wanted me to say.
You told them that he was at home with you at 25 minutes past nine, and now you say that that was a lie?
Yes, a lie.
And when you said that he had accidentally cut his wrist, again you lied?
Yes!
And now today you've told us a new story entirely. The question is, Frau Helm, were you lying then? Are you lying now? Or are you not, in fact, a chronic and habitual liar?
He puts a hand to his heart.
Carter, Carter, the other pill, under the tongue.
My lord, is my learned friend to be allowed to bully and insult the witness in this fashion?
Mr. Myers, this is a capital charge, and within the bounds of reason, I should like the defense to have every latitude.
My lord, may I also remind my learned friend that his witness, by her own admission, has already violated so many oaths that I am surprised the testament did not leap from her hand when she was sworn here today. I doubt if anything is to be gained by questioning you any further. That will be all, Frau Helm.
He sinks into his seat and takes a pill from Carter.
Mrs. Helm, I presume you know the meaning of the English word perjury? In German, the word is Meineid.
Yes, Meineid. It means to swear falsely under oath.
And are you aware, Mrs. Helm, that the penalty in this country for perjury is a heavy term of imprisonment?
Yes, I'm aware.
Mindful of this fact, I asked you once more, is the evidence that you have given the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
So help me God.
Then that, my lord, is a case for the prosecution.
Cool and composed, Christine strides from the courtroom. leaving Vole with his head in his hands and the pretty young woman in the gallery in tears.
Oh, want a tissue? Yes, thanks. It's the first murder trial I've ever been to. It's terrible.
Silence!
Sir Wilfred, are you ready for the defense?
My lord, members of the jury, the prosecution has very ably presented against the prisoner, Leonard Vole, a case of the most overwhelming circumstantial evidence. Among the witnesses, you have heard Chief Inspector Hearn, who has given his testimony in a fair and impartial manner, as he always does in these cases. He has evolved and put before you a clever theory of how this crime was committed. Whether it is theory or actual fact, however, you will decide for yourselves. And then you have heard the evidence of Janet McKenzie, a worthy and devoted housekeeper who has suffered two most grievous losses, one, the death of her beloved mistress, and second, in being deprived of an inheritance of £80,000 which she'd fully expected to receive. I will not comment further on her evidence, but will express only my deepest sympathy for her in both these mishaps. And finally, most damaging of all, the prosecution has produced a surprise witness, one Christine Helm, whom the prisoner married and brought from the rubble of her homeland to the safety of this country, giving her his love and the protection of his name. I objected to her testimony because a wife cannot give evidence harmful to her husband. But it has been proven that her marriage to Leonard Vole was fraudulent and bigamous. Therefore, her evidence must be admitted and you must consider it for what it is worth. Such is the prosecution's case. Now it is the turn of the defense. We could present on behalf of the prisoner a variety of witnesses to his character, his war record, the lack of criminal or evil association in his past. However, only one witness can shed new light on this tragic riddle. The prisoner himself. Members of the jury, I call Leonard Stephen Vole.
The bailiffs escort Vole from the dock to the witness box.
I swear by Almighty God that the evidence I shall give will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but...
Sir Wilfred waves aside a document from Brogan Moore.
Is your name Leonard Stephen Vole?
It is.
Where do you live?
620 Edgware Road.
Leonard Stephen Vole, did you or did you not, on the night of October the 14th last, murder Emily Jane French?
I did not.
Thank you, that will be all. Have you, in fact, concluded your examination of the prisoner, Sir Wilfred? My lord, the prisoner has endured 3 days of the most profound mental agony and shock. The defense feels his faculties should be spared for the cross-examination by my learned friend for the prosecution. This is not a plea for any indulgence. I am confident that no matter how searching this may be, the prisoner will withstand it.
Mr. Vole, at the time that you made the acquaintance of Mrs. French, were you employed?
No, sir.
How much money did you have?
Just a few pounds.
Did she ever give you any money?
No, not a penny.
Do you expect to receive any?
No, sir.
Did you know that in her new will, you were the beneficiary to the extent of £80,000?
No, I didn't.
Now, Mr. Vole, when you went to visit Mrs. French for the last time, did you wear a trench coat and a brown hat?
Yes, I did.
Was it this coat and hat?
Yes, sir.
My lord, the defense, leaving no stone unturned in its efforts to establish an alibi for the prisoner, circulated this photograph, hoping to bring forth a witness who had seen him leaving Mrs. French's house or entering his own at the times that he has stated. Apparently, this splendid effort was without results. However, the defense will be pleased to learn that at the last moment a witness has come forward, and that the prisoner had been seen wearing this coat and this hat. Lamentably, he had not been seen on the night of the murder, but exactly 1 week before. On the afternoon of October the 8th, were you or were you not in a travel agency in Regent Street? And did you or did you not make inquiries about prices and schedules of foreign cruises?
Well, supposing I did. It's not a crime, is it?
Not at all. Many people go on a cruise when they can afford to pay for it. But you couldn't pay for it, could you, Mr. Vole?
Well, I was hard up. I told you that.
And yet you came to this particular travel agency with a clinging brunette.
A clinging brunette, Mr. Myers?
My lord, the young lady was so described to me. She was very affectionate with the prisoner, constantly clinging to his arm.
Oh.
You then admit that you made inquiries about the most expensive and luxurious cruises. How do you expect to pay for such a thing?
I don't know. It was...
If you don't know, perhaps I can help you. On the morning of the very same day, according to Mr. Stokes, you heard Mrs. French change her will, leaving you the bulk of her money.
I didn't. I knew nothing about the will.
And in the afternoon, you started to make plans to dispose of that money.
No, it was nothing of the kind. Look, I was in a pub, and I met this girl. I don't even remember her name now. We had a couple of drinks, and we walked out together. And we passed that display window and saw those fancy posters, all blue seas and palm trees. Grecian Isles or some such place. So we went in just for fun, and I started asking for folders. Well, the man gave me a sort of a funny look. Because I did look a bit shabby. Well, anyway, it irritated me. So I kept asking for the swankiest tours, all deluxe and cabin on the boat deck. But it was just putting on an act.
An act? You knew that in a week you were going to inherit £80,000.
No, it wasn't that way at all. It was make-believe and childish, but it was fun and I enjoyed it. I never thought of killing anyone or of inheriting any money.
It was just a remarkable coincidence that Mrs. French should be killed only 1 week later.
I told you I didn't kill her.
Do you know any reason why the witness, Christine Helm, should deliberately give the evidence she has given if it were not true?
No. I don't know why my wife... I don't even know why I still call her my wife. She must have been lying or out of her mind.
She seemed remarkably sane and self-possessed. But insanity is the only reason that you can suggest.
I don't understand it. Oh, God, what happened? What's changed her?
Very effective, I'm sure. But in this court, we deal with fact. And the fact, Mr. Vole, is that we have only your word for it. That you left Mrs. French's house at the time you say you did. That you came home at 9:25. And that you did not go out again.
But somebody must have seen me in the street or going into the house.
One would certainly think so. But the only person who did see you come home that night says that it was 10:10. And she says that you had blood on your hands.
I cut my wrist.
You cut your wrist deliberately.
No, I didn't. I didn't do anything. But you make it sound as though I did. I can hear it myself.
You came home at 10:10.
No, I didn't. You've got to believe me. You've got to believe me.
You killed Emily French.
No, I didn't. I didn't do it. I didn't kill her. I never killed anybody. God, it's like a nightmare. Some ghastly, horrible dream.
Later in Sir Wilfred's offices.
Good evening, Sir Wilfred. How did it go today?
Sir Wilfred, I'm from Hawkson Hill, sir. And I've brought your Bermuda shorts for a fitting.
He holds them up.
What? You better slip these on, Sir Wilfred, if we're to have them ready by tomorrow.
My dear man, I'm in the middle of a murder trial.
It'll all be over by tomorrow afternoon. The boat train doesn't go until 9:40.
Will you two work it out? You know my shape. You've stabbed it often enough.
Upstairs, Sir Wilfred. You need a lukewarm bath and your calcium injection. Oh, and there's a lot more packing to be done still.
He ignores her and retires into his chambers.
Ridiculous having those boat reservations. How do we know? The jury may be out for days.
Not on this case, I'm afraid. It seems too open and shut.
Sir Wilfred sinks into a chair.
I watched them when Frau Helm was on the stand. They didn't like her.
No, they didn't like her, but they believed her. They liked Leonard Vole, but they didn't believe him.
And that travel agency business doesn't help either. Cigar, Wilfred?
No. Wilfred, do you think she lied?
Well, don't you?
I don't know. I'm not sure.
I am. She lied. Whether she called it minor or perjury, she lied. The only question in my mind is why? What's her game? What is she up to? What?
He slams his desk.
Sir Wilfred, I hope that in your final speech tomorrow you won't let yourself become too emotionally involved. You must think of your physical condition.
He's right, you know. I want to see you save yourself. This isn't going to be your last case.
Yes, it is. But until it's over, I'm still a barrister. My client's life's at stake. That's all that matters, his life. He's entitled to the best that I can do. If I can't stand up to make my final appeal for him, I'll make it sitting down. I become short of breath, I'll take a pill or two pills or all of them, and the box as well.
Yes?
Is this the Wilford Grobox place?
Oh, yes, it is.
Let me talk to the old geezer.
Who is this speaking, please?
Never you mind. Let me talk to him.
I'm afraid that will be impossible. What is the nature of your business?
It's business, all right. I've got something to sell him, I have.
Well, really, madam.
And what I've got to sell him, believe me, he'll want to buy. It's got to do with that Leonard Vole.
Leonard Vole?
It's about that German wife. I've got the goods on her, and it's for sale.
Sir Wilfred grabs the phone.
This is Wilfred Robart speaking. Now, what is this all about?
Well, hello, ducky.
What is this you said about Mrs. Leonard Vole?
I'm not just science. I've got it in black and white.
You've got what?
Listen to this carefully, ducks. I'm at the Buffet at Euston Station at the far end of the bar. And I'd be here for just 30 minutes because that's when we try and leave. If you want the lowdown on that German bag, you get yourself over here.
What lowdown? What do you know about her?
Uh-uh. Not on the phone. You better get on over here and bring plenty of money.
The dark-haired caller hangs up.
Just a moment. Hello. Hello.
Bilge. Some drunken crank, you get those in every murder trial. Giving me an ultimatum, Euston Station in 30 minutes. Got the lowdown on Mrs. Vole. Balderdash. I'm too old and too sick to go on a wild goose chase. Come on, Mayhew.
Where to, Sir Wilfred?
Euston Station. Where do you think?
He grabs his hat and cane and strides out.
Now, sir.
He thrusts the shorts aside and holds up two fingers.
Sir Wilfred, where are you going? Your bath, your massage, your dinner, your injection.
Turning back,
thank you, Miss Plimpton.
He uses the syringe to poke a hole in the end of his cigar and then dashes off with Mayhew. A little later, they enter the bar at Euston Station. Mayhew spots the dark-haired woman slouching at the end of the counter near the phone booth. They approach her.
You wouldn't be Sir Wilfred, would you?
I would.
Didn't recognize you without your wig. Lovely you all looking them wigs. Two of you. I'm not talking to two of you.
This is Mr. Mayhew, Leonard Vole's solicitor.
Well, that's all right then, isn't it?
And your name, please.
No need for names. If I did give you a name, it mightn't be the right one. Might it? Have a drink, boys. Two whiskies for me gentlemen friends.
Now, what is this information you allegedly have?
You realize, of course, you're in duty bound to come forward to give any evidence you might have in your possession.
Now, come off it. Did you bring any money?
What is it you have, madam?
Letters. Letters that German wife of his wrote. That's what I've got.
Letters written by Christine Vole to the prisoner?
To the prisoner? Don't make me laugh. Poor bleeder, he's been taken by her, all right. And these letters prove it.
If we could see these letters, madam, we shall be able to advise you as to how pertinent they are.
Well, I don't expect you.
Pulling the letters from her purse, she beckons them aside.
Well, as I say, I don't expect you to buy without seeing, but fair's fair. If these letters get the boy off, well, it's £100 for me, right?
If these letters contain information useful to the defense, I'm prepared to offer you £10.
What? 10 bleeding pounds for letters like these? You can take that piece of glass out of your eye. Good night, gents.
These should help to prove my client's innocence. £20 would, I think, not be an unreasonable sum for your expenses.
15, it's a bargain. That's if you're satisfied with what's in them.
£40.
All right, blast you. Here, take them. Nice little lot there.
How do we know these are from Mrs. Vole?
Oh, she wrote them all right. It's all fair and square.
She stuffs the money in her purse as the lawyers inspect the letters.
I hope they fix her good and proper.
I've had messages from Mrs. Vole. It looks like her handwriting. Good heavens, look at this.
Juicy, ain't they? There's one coming up that's even better.
How did you get hold of these?
What difference does it make so long as she gets what's coming to her?
What have you got against her?
I'll give you something to dream about, mister. Want to kiss me, ducky?
She brushes the dark hair back from her cheek, revealing a dreadful scar.
Ha! I didn't suppose you would.
Christine Vole did that to you.
Not her. The chap I was going with, he was a bit younger than me, but I loved him. And then she come along, started seeing him on the sly, and then one day he cleared out. But I went after him and I found him together. I told him what I thought of her and he cut me face up proper.
Did you go to the police about it?
Who, me? Not likely. Besides, it wasn't his fault, not really. It was hers, it was all hers, getting him away from me, turning him against me. But I waited me time to pay her back. And it's come now.
I'm deeply sorry, deeply sorry. We'll make it another £5 for the letters.
Holding out on me, were you? I knew I was being too soft with you.
Cold blooded vindictiveness. Read this one.
Mayhew hands Sir Wilfred another letter.
Unbelievable. We'd better have the full name of the man to whom these were addressed, Miss... Where is she?
The dark-haired woman slips out the door of the bar and hurries toward a departing train.
On that train, I should think. Just doesn't want her other cheek slashed. Can't blame her, can you?
Flicking off his monocle, Sir Wilfred tosses back his shot of whiskey.
Care for another, sir?
Good idea.
He tosses back Mayhew's shot as well. The next day in the courtroom, Leonard Vole is escorted into the prisoner's dock.
Silence! Be upstanding in court. All persons who have anything further to do before my lords, the Queen's Justices of Oye and Termini, and General Jay Delivery for the jurisdiction of the Central Criminal Court, draw near and give your attendance. God save the Queen.
The judge nods to the jury, the barristers, and the court usher. And then everyone sits down.
Since the defense has called but one witness, the prisoner, it has the right to be heard last. Therefore, Mr. Miles, if you are ready, let us have the final address for the prosecution.
My lord, members of the jury, I will be brief in my final speech, because I think that the prosecution has proved so obvious a case of murder against the prisoner, Leonard Vole, that a verdict of guilty must be the only possible conclusion. I will briefly summarize these facts.
Everyone turns to look as Sir Wilfred hurries in, pulling on his wig.
You better begin again, Mr. Myers. That is, if Sir Wilfred is at all interested in our proceedings.
I am indeed, my lord. The speech for the Crown, however, is premature. I ask that the case for the defense be reopened, and that a witness be recalled.
My lord, I must strenuously object to the case being reopened at this final stage.
Evidence of the most startling nature came into my possession only last night.
My lord, the course my learned friend proposes is quite unprecedented.
I have anticipated my friend's objection and am prepared to meet it with ample precedent. There is first the case of the King against Stillman reported in the Criminal Appeal Reports of 1936 at page 463. Also the King against Porter in volume 1 of the King's Bench Division Reports 1942 at page 153. And lastly, there is the case of the King against Sullivan, in which this issue was raised, which I'm sure your lordship will remember, since your lordship appeared for the prosecution.
I did? Oh, yes, before Mr. Justice Swindon. Now, what is this new evidence, Sir Wilfred?
Letters, my lord. Letters written by Christine Helm.
He passes them along to the judge.
My lord, the prosecution continues its objection. If my memory serves me well, your lordship's similar rejection in the King against Sullivan was sustained.
The judge inspects one of the letters.
Your memory for once serves you ill, Mr. Myers. My objection then was overruled by Mr. Justice Swindon, as yours is now by me.
The letters are passed back to Sir Wilfred.
Call Christine Helm!
Christine Helm!
Christine Helm!
Sir Wilfred gives a reassuring nod to Vole, who turns to watch, as Christine, cool and composed, enters the courtroom and makes her way toward the witness box. Sir Wilfred slips the letters under a book and leans close to Brogan Moore.
If you still have any doubts about Leonard Vole, I wouldn't mind betting you a very small box of cigars.
Mrs. Helm, You appreciate you are still under oath.
Yes.
Mrs. Helm, do you know a man named Max?
I don't know what you mean.
It's a simple question. Do you or do you not know a man called Max?
Max? Certainly not.
It's a fairly common name, and yet you mean you've never known a man with the name of Max?
Oh, in Germany, perhaps, but that was a long time ago.
I shall not ask you to go back that far, just a few weeks to, October the 20th, last.
He's pulled a sheet of paper from his pocket.
What have you got there?
A letter. I suggested on October the 20th. You wrote a certain letter.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Addressed to a man named Max.
I did nothing of the sort.
The letter was but one of a series written to the same man.
Lies. All lies.
You would seem to have been on, well, let us say, on intimate terms with this man.
How dare you say a thing like that? It isn't true.
I'm not concerned with the general trend of this correspondence, only with one particular letter. My beloved Max. An extraordinary thing has happened. I believe all our difficulties may be ended.
I will not stand here and listen to a pack of lies. That letter's a forgery. It isn't even my letter paper.
It isn't?
No. I write my letters on small blue paper with my initials on it.
Sir Wilfred holds up the letters.
Like this?
He lifts the sheet of paper.
This happens to be a bill from my tailor for a pair of extremely becoming Bermuda shorts.
Plimsoll turns to the young woman.
Wilfred the Fox. That's what we call him, and that's what he is.
Now, Mrs. Helm, you've been kind enough to identify your letter paper. Now, if you like, I can have an expert identify your handwriting.
Damn you! Damn you!
Leave her alone!
Daniel!
Mrs. Helm!
Let me go! Let me get out of here! Let me go!
Mrs. Helm!
Let me go!
Asha, give the witness a chair. Oh. Oh.
She slumps on the chair, burying her face in her hands.
Sir Wilfred, will you now read the letter in question so that the jury may hear it?
My beloved Max... An extraordinary thing has happened. All our difficulties may soon be solved. Leonard is suspected of murdering the old lady I told you about. His only hope of an alibi depends on me alone. Suppose I testify that he was not at home with me at the time of the murder, that he came home with blood on his sleeves, and that he even admitted to me that he killed her. Strange, isn't it? He always said that he would never let me leave him, but now, if this succeeds, he will be leaving me because they will take him away forever. And I shall be free and yours, my beloved. I count the hours until we are together, Christine.
Mrs. Helm? Will you go back to the witness box?
Collecting herself, Christine returns to the stand.
I now ask you again, Christine Helm, did you write this letter?
Christine, tell him that you didn't write it. I know you didn't.
Please answer my question. Did you write this letter?
Before answering, Mrs. Helm, I wish to warn you that the law regarding perjury in this country is very severe. If you have already committed perjury in this courtroom, I strongly advise you not to add to your crime. But if this letter has not been written by you, then now is the time to state this fact.
I wrote the letter.
And that, my lord, is the case for the defense.
Sir Wilfred sits down. Vole stares at Christine. Soon after, in the barrister's cloakroom.
I keep asking myself, Sir Wilfred, which is harder, your head or your arteries? You better stop pressing your luck. You're overdue now.
We're all packed and ready, Doctor. I hope the jury won't take all the afternoon.
I concede. Congratulations. Here are your cigars.
Not yet.
Come on, it's all over. Wrapped up, neat and tidy.
What's wrong?
It's a little too neat, too tidy.
and altogether too symmetrical. That's what's wrong with it.
The jury is just coming back.
You're not worried about the verdict, are you?
It's not their judgment that worries me. It's mine.
He throws up his hands.
Where's my wig?
Leonard Vole waits anxiously in the dock. He looks up as the jury files in. The lawyers enter. Miss Plimsoll finds a seat in the gallery. Christine watches through the door.
Prisoner will stand up. Members of the jury, are you all agreed upon your verdict?
The foreman rises.
We are.
Do you find the prisoner at the bar, Leonard Stephen Vole, guilty or not guilty of the murder of Emily Jane French?
Not guilty, my lord.
Vole sinks back. Sir Wilfred watches Christine, who heaves a great sigh and slumps against the wall. When Brogan Moore taps his shoulder, he acknowledges the prosecutor's congratulation.
Leonard Stephen Vole, you have been found not guilty of the murder of Emily Jane French on October the 14th. You are hereby discharged and are free to leave the court.
Vole nods. All rise when the judge stands up. He nods to the jury, the barristers, and the court usher, and starts out.
All persons who have anything further to do before my lord, the Queen's Justices of Oyer and Terminy and General Jail Delivery for the jurisdiction of Central Criminal Court may depart here.
Vole shakes hands with his bailiffs and then makes his way through a crowd of well-wishers to his defense team.
Thank you.
Yes, we'll talk later.
Mr. Mayfield. Thank you, Mr. Brogan Moore. Carter. Thank you, Sir Wilfred. Thank you for everything. You were wonderful.
Say we were lucky all around.
Yeah.
No, I have your belongings. If you'll come with me, Mr. Vole, and sign the receipt, we can release you.
Mr. Vole? They didn't call me Mr. when they charged me.
I'll go with you. I brought your hat and coat.
Yes, let's go quickly before they change their mind.
Grinning, he follows the bailiff off with Mayhew.
Very chipper, isn't he? An hour ago, he had one foot on the gallows and the other on a banana peel. You ought to be very proud, Wilfred. Aren't you?
Not yet. You've disposed of the gallows, but there's still that banana peel somewhere under somebody's foot.
Out in the hall, an angry crowd closes in on Christine. The court usher and two bailiffs hurry out to rescue her. The usher brings her into the courtroom.
You'd better wait here until we get rid of that crowd, madam.
Thank you.
The usher goes out to help the bailiffs.
Ready, sir? Miss Plimsoll will be waiting.
Let me finish the last of the cocoa while I'm still beyond her jurisdiction. Would you excuse me, Brogan Moore, Carter?
As they leave, Sir Wilfred sits down again. He watches Christine brush herself off and check the damage to her appearance. Aware of him, she crosses toward the judge's bench. Taking a mirror from her purse, she props it against the bench rail, then glances over at him.
I never thought you British could get so emotional, especially in a public place.
I apologize for my compatriots.
Oh, it's all right. I don't mind being called names or pushed around or even kicked in the shin. But now I have a ladder and my last pair of nylons.
In case you are not familiar with our prison regulations, no silk stockings.
Prison? Will I go to prison?
You heard the learned judge, who will quite certainly be charged with perjury, tried for it, and to prison you shall go.
Well, it won't be for life, will it?
If I were appearing for the prosecution, it would be.
You loathe me, don't you? Like the people outside. what a wicked woman I am, and how brilliantly you exposed me and saved Leonard's life. The great Sir Wilfred Robarts did it again. Well, let me tell you something. You didn't do it alone. You had help.
What are you driving at?
I'm not driving at anything anymore. Leonard is free, and we did it.
We?
Remember? When I came to see you and you said that no jury would believe an alibi given by a loving wife, no matter how much she swore her husband was innocent, that gave me the idea.
What idea?
The idea that I should be a witness. Not for my husband, but for the prosecution, that I should swear Leonard was guilty, and that you should expose me as a vicious liar, because only then would they believe Leonard was innocent. So now you know the whole story.
When he peers at her uncertainly, she smiles.
I'll give you something to dream about, mister. Wanna kiss me, ducky?
She brushes the blonde hair back from her unmarked cheek. Sir Wilfred is astonished.
I suspected something, but not that. Never that.
Thank you for the compliment. It's been a long time since I was an actress, and I never before played such an important role.
And all those blue letters.
Took me hours to write them, to invent Max. There never was a Max. There's never been anyone but Leonard, only Leonard.
My dear, could you not have trusted me, worked with me truthfully and honorably? We would have won.
I could not run that risk. You see, you thought he was innocent.
And you knew he was innocent, I understand.
No, Sir Wilfred, you do not understand at all. I knew he was guilty.
That can't be so! No!
She faces him.
Listen to me once and for all. Leonard came home a few minutes past 10. He did have blood on his sleeves. He did tell me he had killed the woman, only I could save him. He pleaded with me.
And you saved him, a murderer.
Again, you don't understand. I love him.
They both turn. Vole has reappeared. He chuckles.
I told you she was an actress. And a good one.
Leonard!
He comes around the dock to them.
I knew she was going to do something for me, but I just didn't know what or how.
Leonard!
She hugs him and kisses him.
Fooled you completely, didn't she?
It was you, Vole, who fooled me.
He throws down his wig.
Oh, easy, easy. Now, we both got out of this alive. Let's stay this way. Where are your pills?
Vole, you have made a mockery of English law.
Who did? You got me off, and I can't be tried again for this. That's English law, too, isn't it?
You can't touch him now. Nobody can.
The scales of justice may tip one way or another, but ultimately they balance out. You'll pay for this.
Oh, ultimately is a long way off. I'd rather pay for it as soon as possible and in cash. Suppose we double your fee. There'll be plenty of money as soon as the will goes through. Why not cheap? I want everybody to get something out of this. Now, there's Janet McKenzie. We'll get her that new hearing aid.
He picks up the thermos.
We'll get you a new one of these. 18-karat gold if they make them.
He looks at Christine.
When they try you for perjury, there'll be £5,000 for the best defense you can get.
I don't care, Leonard. Just so we'll be together again. You don't know what I went through. Standing in the witness box, having to face you in the dock, saying I never loved you.
Miss Plimsoll bustles in with the pretty young woman.
Sir Wilfred, the luggage is in the car, and we've only 20 minutes to catch the boat train. A nice young lady I met in the gallery during the trial.
The young woman runs into his open arms. They kiss.
Oh, Leonard, they've been trying to keep me away from you. It's had me nearly crazy.
Leonard, who's this girl?
I'm not this girl. I'm his girl. Tell her, Len.
Leonard, is this the girl who was with you in the travel bureau? The girl you said you hardly knew, didn't even know her name?
That's right. That's who I am, and I know all about you. You're not his wife, never have been. You're years older than he is. We've been going together for months, and we're going away on one of those cruises, just like they said in court. Tell her yourself, Len.
Yes, Len. Tell me yourself.
All right, Diana, come along.
You can't, Leonard. Not after what I've done. I won't let you.
Don't be silly.
I saved your life getting you out of Germany. You saved mine getting me out of this mess, so we're even. It's all over now.
Don't, Leonard.
She clutches at him.
Don't, Leonard, don't!
Pull yourself together. They'll have you up here for perjury. Well, don't make it worse. Or they'll try you as an accessory.
He thrusts her down by the evidence table.
You know what that means.
I don't care. Let them. Let them try me for perjury. Or an accessory, or...
She sees the sharp knife on the table.
Better yet.
Grabbing it...
Let them try me for...
She steps to him and thrusts it into his chest. He crumples to the floor. Miss Plimsoll kneels down and feels for his pulse. As the court usher hurries in with some bailiffs, she steps towards Sir Wilfrid.
Call a doctor.
It's no use. No doctor can help now.
Carter rushes in.
What happened?
She killed him.
Killed him? She executed him.
Carter, what have you done with the luggage?
I've sent it on ahead to the station, and I've got a cab waiting outside.
They turn as Christine is taken away by the bailiffs.
A remarkable woman.
You can just barely catch the boat train, Sir Wilfrid.
Better bring the luggage back, and you can dismiss the cab. We are not going yet, are we?
She hands Sir Wilfrid his wig.
Thank you, Miss Plimsoll. Get Broganmore to my chambers and have Mayhew there, too. We're appearing for the defense and the trial of Christine Vole.
He starts out.
Sir Wilfrid! You've forgotten your brandy.
She picks up the thermos and steps after him. Smiling, he slips an arm around her shoulders, and they go out together. The end.
This audio cinema presentation was created by AudioVision Canada. For information on other audio cinema presentations and described video products available from AudioVision Canada, call 1-800-567-6755.